Good morning. My name is Eileen, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Founding president and member of FAF. FAF is a great organization. We have no meetings, nothing to attend, no steps to work. Just have to be femme and hate football. But we're a wide open organization. We have auxiliaries, we have BAF, Butchers Against Football. We have BFF, Butchers for Football. Femmes for Football, there aren't very many of those, but there's a few I've discovered. I guess that would be Triple F. Femmes for Football. Anyway, I want to thank the committee for asking me to come. I really appreciate it. I've had a wonderful time here. I feel like all the bodily fluids have been sucked out of my body, however. I've never been so dry in my life. But that, of course, has been compensated for by the fact that I've won some money, and it's so great. Oh, the sound of those coins coming out of those slot machines just makes me so happy. My sponsee, Cher, was worried about me because my friend Eileen here, who I've known my whole sobriety, actually, I told Eileen that we should get married yesterday because in my experience, people with matching names stay together. My parents are Harry and Harriet, and they've been together for 53 years, you know what I mean? So, and we're Eileen and Eileen. We went up to, she took me to the lovely Pepper Mill with the beautiful fake pink trees in the coffee shop. I like that very much. And as beautiful as going to Keith Ann's is all I have to say. The Peppermill, those casinos are like being on acid, aren't they? Oh, my God. Oh, the noises, the light, stuff. Anyway, we went over there, and they asked our name, and she says, Eileen, that would be either one of us. And then they give you a buzzer, and you can go off and play the slots while you're waiting for your table. It was so great. And anyway, I don't know what the point of this story was. I know. Because my all-girl gang, including Don, wanted to go see In-N-Out. We had the gay row in the theater. The rest of Reno was not getting it, is all I have to say. We're like howling and slapping high fives and going on and going crazy. The rest of the theater is like a tomb, you know, but our row is like, yeah, yeah, and weeping and carrying on. Oh, man, it was incredible. Anyway, and passing food up and down the row and, you know, the whole thing. And so we had this plan to go to the movies, and I was going to come back, but it's 5 minutes to 11, and I'm still at the machines. And so I called, and Cher sounded really worried, and then they put the big gun, Don, on the phone, and he said, you know, he said, if you don't come to the movie, girl, you're going to be sorry, you know. And so fortunately, Eileen and I got to the theater before the rest of them did, because Don and Christine went looking for me in the casino, and Don told me that he was going to come up to me and say, God damn it, what are you doing in here? The kids are out in the car. And and you're in here with this goddamn lesbian again. And he was going to drag my butt out of that casino. I enjoy theater. I would have had a good time. Except that Eileen has to live here. I was going home. But, I have a lot of fun in sobriety. But I also take it very, very seriously. And my sobriety date is March 3rd, 1975, for which I'm very grateful. Which means that I used to be a young person in AA, and now I'm old. But That is, as far as I can tell, the biggest drawback of long-term sobriety. You get older along with staying sober. And but I do things to maintain my youth, like high levels of immaturity. Of course, many of you were admiring my teenage skateboard sneakers yesterday. Anyway, I'm supposed to tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I was born 46 years ago in Boise, Idaho. Odd place to be born anyway. But particularly if your parents happen to be Jews from the Bronx. And and they were and are. And they ended up there through a series of misunderstandings by the military. And but my father, who had been a semi-professional baseball player in Brooklyn, got a job as a minor league baseball announcer and disc jockey, and so we lived there for about 10 years. But I left when I was 4. I don't even know why I ever mentioned Boise. I don't remember it, and I've never been back. But you'd think I'd want to see the place where I was born, but I really don't have any interest. And anyway, we moved to Los Angeles when I was 4. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley. Fortunately, I left the San Fernando Valley before girls started talking like that. But so I've maintained my well-modulated tones. As I say, the first time I heard Sherry was in Tacoma, Washington, and Sherry and I have the exact opposite academic trajectory. Sherry was a complete fuck-up as a child and then achieved greatness. I achieved greatness as a child, peaked at 11 and a half, and it was downhill from there. And true. I was the star of my grammar school. I was the undisputed star of my grammar school. I was ahead of everything, the safeties, the student council. I was the teacher's pet, the principal's pet, the nurse's pet. I was a big kiss-ass is what I was. I was, the cashier in the cafeteria, and I was mistress of ceremonies at my grade school graduation, where I got to do square dance calls in phonetic Portuguese. I'm fairly certain none of you got to do that. The closest I've gotten to it since was, I think I was with Miss Irene. We did same-sex square dancing and living sober. Which is so confusing. The ones who were playing the men got red armbands. I was a red armband that night. Anyway. I'm certain, if they had taken a vote when I was young, they would have voted me most likely to succeed. I'm fairly certain that nobody would have said at that time that by the time you reach age 23, you're going to be a 230-pound, drunken, sleazy, dope-fiend broad. I mean, I'm sure they never said that, but that was what I became by the time I was 23 years old. I was always a very weird kid. I mean, in addition to, being an achiever and, living with the burden of tremendous potential all of my life. I have a lot of potential, as do many of us. And I'm beginning to realize some of it now, but, I mean, I had a lot of potential. Oh, Nathan. Oh, hi. You gotta love this kid. You just gotta love. Oh, Nathan. Is he the best or what? Huh? I'm in love. Don's fallen in love about 20 times this weekend. I've only fallen in love once with Nathan. Anyway, sweet. Anyway, that baby stands a chance because he's here with us in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyhow, I was a very strange kid. I was a very self-involved kid. I was, the book tells us that we're self obsessed and self-centered and self-seeking. And I was that way my entire life, except that I just didn't know it. You know, I was a very self-involved. I was deeply interested from a very young age as to how I was impacting the planet. This was very important to me. You know, what kind of impact I was having. And, I was kind of like, you know, a dog in a way. You know how dogs are kind of pathetic and desperate, you know how they are? I mean, like, cats are sort of like this, but, you know, dogs are, like, really pathetic and in their own way. And they're always wanting to know how they're doing, you know. Dogs are always coming up. Like, particularly, like, my boss has a yellow Labrador. This is a perfect example of this type of dog, where the dog, you know, comes up to you and it's like, how am I doing? How am I doing, you know? And you pat the dog and you go, hey, you're doing fine. You're doing fine, Roger. You're doing really fine. Go lay down. And about 5 minutes later, they're back. How am I doing? How am I doing? Am I doing okay now? How am I doing? And I was kind of like that. You know, I always wanted to know how I was doing. And I never thought very well of myself, you know. I heard a speaker say something about a year and a half ago. I loved it so much. He said, you know, I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. And fabulous. Anyway, being a gifted child, I skipped half of the sixth grade. They did me no favor. I went into junior high school. I was now with a group of kids I didn't know. I was in an environment that I didn't control. I was now a small fish in a big pond instead of the biggest fish in the small pond. I didn't like that. And when I was about 12 years old, I found the boys who had beer. Gotta love the boys who have beer, I'm telling you. And I started to drink. Now, I believe that I drank alcoholically from the moment I started to drink. I didn't waste a lot of time. I got here when I was 24 years old, never to my knowledge having had a social drink in my life. What a waste of time that is. You know, like having martinis and things when eventually you're just going to end up drinking Ripple. Why not start out drinking Ripple? You haven't lived till you've puked pagan pink through your nose. I'm basically a cheap, sleazy drunk, okay? I mean, that's who I am. There's nothing elegant about how I drink. I drank to get drunk. That's why I drank. I immediately discovered what alcohol was for. Alcohol is for getting drunk. There's no other reason to drink alcohol. I don't understand social drinking. I don't understand those people at all. In fact, I don't even think those folks should be allowed to drink, quite frankly. You know, it's like, you know, the people who lean up against the bar and they go, oh, no more for me. I'm beginning to feel it. Hello? There are some people who drink to get into life. There are other people who drink to get out of life. I drank to get out of life, and I don't know why. I mean, I don't know why I found living in reality so painful, but I did. I mean, I've never been the kind of person who's moved through life like a hot knife through cold butter, you know? I mean, there's some people who seem to have an easy time of it. I'm not. I never have been. And thank God I found Alcoholics Anonymous, because Alcoholics Anonymous is an organization that doesn't make you feel ashamed because you need help to get through the day. You know what I mean? I need a lot of help, but I didn't know it back then. So I found my help in chemicals, you know, and my chemicals really helped me just get through the day, you know, because I didn't want to be here. You know, there's, I go to a Monday night meeting down in West Hollywood, and they read a portion from one of the stories in the back of the book where it says, we reject fantasy and accept reality. And I would turn to my neighbor and go, maybe you do, you know. But I like fantasy. I like rationalization. I like denial. They still work. Hardly anything else does, but they work. And, you know, I can live in that. Boy, I can live in that, you know, and I can get help, too, for people in Alcoholics Anonymous who want to help me do that. A couple of years ago, I went down to Mexico to visit a friend of mine who lives down in this little town called San Miguel de Allende. It's a fabulous little town. I went there to celebrate my favorite personal holiday, the Day of the Dead. And I had to add to my huge collection of Day of the Dead folk art. I've had people walk into my house and go, are you obsessed with death? No, quite the contrary. I'm obsessed with life. I just think that, you know, people down south have a better attitude about it. But anyway, I was down there, and there's one meeting a day, English-speaking meeting a day in this little town, and that, you know, was sort of, you know, pretty much started by my friend who lives down there, who I know from New York, actually. I met him at the International in Montreal. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about here this weekend is the interconnectedness of so many of us in this room. I mean, there are people here that I know from Los Angeles. There are people here that I have sponsored who now live in Sacramento and Seattle. My friend Christine is here. She was my hostess at the Houston Roundup 10 years ago. I got home and I called some of my friends and I said, oh, they are so hospitable in Houston. They gave me the cutest woman at the conference to be my hostess. I'm telling you, I love Texas. You know? You know, and Christine was in Seattle, and when my girls, Cher and Jennifer, moved up to Seattle, I said, you got to call Christine, and they've become the best of friends. And I met Sherry in Tacoma, and I've known Donald since he came to the program, and he's my heart, you know, and Marty, who was in the program when I got here, and Eileen, and, you know, it's really something to have that sort of connectedness to people. So I'm down in Mexico visiting this guy that I met at the International in Montreal who lived in New York and now lives in Mexico, and, Anyway, there was a fellow down there at about 30 years, this retired sea captain from Houston named Charlie Threadgill. And we went, there's a town there called, the hell is that town called? I don't know. Something Hidalgo. And, but they have, what I remember about it is they have the famous street ice cream. And this is a stupid story and I'm going to stop because I don't know what my point is. Yeah, I took a lot of acid and actually I have a friend named Cheryl who's wonderful. Cheryl is closer to 80 than she is to 70, but she'd never tell you. She's sort of my role model. And anyway, she says the thing that causes you to put the orange juice in the cupboard and the glass in the refrigerator is not senility at all. It's information overload. And eventually some of the information just has to seep out your ears and down your neck. So take heart if you, like me, live in a one-bedroom apartment, walk from the bedroom to the kitchen and have to think, why am I here? And that's where rationalization comes in. You can fake yourself out and go, get a glass of water. Yeah, yeah, that's why you're there. Anyway, I started to drink, like I said, when I was about 12. I drank and used drugs for 12 years only. I make no apology about using drugs. I love the controversy about drugs and Alcoholics Anonymous. I really do, you know, because eventually, this is really the truth, the demographic is going to change to the point that there will be no pure alcoholics left in AA. That's just the way it is. Because I grew up during the 60s, and when I came to the program, they stressed the concept of clean and sober. You know, they didn't say to me, well, you know, you can stop drinking that wine and that vodka, but, you know, you can just keep on taking those Red Devils and smoking that non-habit-forming pot that I smoked every day for 10 years, you know. I mean, you can do that, you know, and then probably have a little acid trip every once in a while. I mean, they didn't say that to me. They said, you know, you got to let go of everything that affects you from the neck up. And, you know, I don't have an exciting drinking story. I think very few of us have really exciting drinking stories. I think most of us have pathetic little drinking stories. And, you know, I mean, I remember when I was new, you know, people would get up here and have these incredible stories. I mean, they would say things like, I took a drink and I ended up in Bangkok. I think, Jesus, I wish I'd ended up anywhere. But, you know, I like to drink and take medication intended for sleep, so I don't go too far, you know. I don't take a lot of action. I take a lot of unscheduled naps, but I don't take a lot of action. And those could be anywhere. I mean, they could be in the street. They could be on the floor of a concert hall. They could be on top of your boyfriend or girlfriend. They could be anywhere. You know, I just never know where I'm going to be when I come to. And but believe me, it's never as far as places like Bangkok. And anyway, I drank like a pig. I just drank like a pig. I drank as much as I could, as often as I could, you know. And I drank for the effect. I mean, I drank for what alcohol would do for me, which was to take me away from here, because I didn't want to be here. And, you know, things happened along the way. You know, I am no stranger to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization and degradation, you know. But the interesting thing that happens to people like me is that becomes a way of life. And you don't even notice anymore. that pitiful and degrading things are happening to you because you think you're such a piece of crap that that's what's supposed to happen to you. You know, when I was 18 years old, I got gang raped, and I got up the next morning and went to the beach as though nothing had happened. Now, that's something that could happen to anybody. You know, of course, if I hadn't been as loaded, it probably wouldn't have happened. The thing that devastated me about that was not that it had happened, but the fact that I couldn't care about it. And I was 18 years old. You see, because I had gone so far in my drinking by the time I was 18 that I couldn't allow any of this stuff. I mean, I really, really identify with Sherry. I was not tough. But I could never, ever, ever let you know that any of that stuff got to me. Ever. You know. Ever. And I convinced all of you and pretty much convinced myself that I didn't care about what happened to me. And, you know, a lot of what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I've not only had to learn how to care about you, but I've had to learn to care about what happens to me. And that's been a long road for me. That's been a long road for me because I came here, you know, like many people do, just in complete and utter and total self-loathing. And the road back from that has been really long. And, you know, I'm grateful that I'm not a quick study. I mean, I'm grateful that I'm not somebody, because I'm really pretty smart. And I'm grateful that I'm not a person, you know, because, you know, if AA was the kind of program where you could read the big book and be out of here in a couple of weeks, I probably would have tried to do that. But AA is not a program where you study the book and you're out of here in a couple of weeks. AA is a program of actions that you have to take over and over and over and over and over and over again in order to maintain your sobriety and your spiritual condition. I mean, that's just the way it is in my experience, which is why I'm still an active member of AA all these years later. But anyway, so I drank and used for a total of 12 years. I attended my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the summer of 1974. I was 23 years old. There were not a lot of young people in AA in those days. There were not a lot of attractive young people like we see in AA now. I was one of the most unattractive of the unattractive young people. As elegant as I look this morning is as inelegant as I looked in 1974. I was wearing a $5.99 granny dress from Zodi's and a pair of Zoris. Tying your shoes got way too complicated. Anything you could just slide your old feet into was fine. Bad haircut, horrible attitude. Now, I'm of the belief that you do not need to come to AA with a good attitude. In fact, most people can't. I mean, why would you? But I'll tell you what I had going for me. I had willingness going for me. I did not have graciousness going for me, and they are two different things. I have learned that if you take the actions, even if you take them with the worst attitude possible, they still work. And as a result of taking the actions, your attitude actually changes. That's what's happened to me. They used to say that you cannot think yourself into right action, but you can act yourself into right thinking. So when I came in 1974, I didn't get sober. I went to meetings in Hollywood. I leaned against walls with my arms folded and glared at people and dared them to come near me. And quite frankly, most of them didn't, you know. I didn't get a book. I didn't get a sponsor. I sort of hung around in AA sort of like this. And needless to say, I didn't get sober either. You know, I didn't know I didn't know what an alcoholic was. I wasn't sure if I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what was going on. I just didn't know what was going on. And I don't call that period of time slipping. It was not slipping. I was drunk for 5 months, and every once in a while I wasn't drunk. But basically, I was just drunk for 5 months hanging around Alcoholics Anonymous. When the holidays rolled around in 1974, I thought to myself, what's the point of sticking around this outfit? You are not sober anyway. And so I decided I'd go out and drink. And my vague plan, I had many vague plans in those days, very few of which ever sort of came true, but my vague plan was to come back after the first of the year. My birthday is March 3rd, so it took a little longer than I thought it would. I got to tell you something. I was talking to Don about this. I said, you know, it's wonderful to get asked to talk at conferences, and I get asked to talk at like 3 or 4 of them a year. And I think it's great, and I think that I have a message to carry and all of that. But you know what impresses me even more than that? That I get to the airport on time. On the right day. That I have my ticket. That I show up where I say I'm going to show up. In Alcoholics Anonymous, my word means something. You know, I don't remember when I was called to ask, you know, to talk at this conference. I don't remember when they called me. But I put it in my book. And I said to Paul, I said, thank you very much. I'd love to come. I'll be there. When I was drinking, I could never, ever make you that kind of promise. Ever. Because I never knew where I would be on the day that I was supposed to be, wherever it was that I said I was going to be. You know, and, even like yesterday when we were supposed to go to the movies and I realized it was 5 minutes to 11 and I was still gambling, I picked up the phone and said, I'm not where I'm supposed to be. And then I got bullied into going. Anyway, So I left and I came back on March 3rd of 1975. Now, I wouldn't have taken any odds on me. I really wouldn't. I wouldn't have taken any odds on me. But angels intervene in our lives. I'm convinced of this. I mean, you know, Sherry talked about it last night. My angel came on March 4th, 1975. I was in a meeting at an old clubhouse in North Hollywood, California called Radford. I was hanging around like I had before in the past. And a man named Bob Earl that I had met in 1974 backed me up against the wall in that clubhouse and he said to me, look, punk. He said, you have a serious problem with alcohol and drugs and you better goddamn well get sober or you're going to die. And he backed it up by saying, and if you don't get sober, I'm going to break your jaw. Now, I don't know what you would have thought. I thought, he cares. And then I wanted to know why. You know, there are some people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they are able to accept the love of the group almost immediately. And they're open to it, and it's fantastic if that's your experience. That was not my experience. I didn't think that I was worthy of the love of this group. I didn't understand why you were being so nice to me. Where I was coming from the last few years before I got sober, if somebody was nice to you, it's because they wanted something. And if you were nice to somebody, it's because you wanted something. And I couldn't figure out why the people in AA were being so nice to me because I knew I had nothing to offer to anyone at all. And he was being nice to me. Now, I think about this very often. When I turned 20 years sober, I had this sort of epiphany, and I thought about what it is that happens here in Alcoholics Anonymous and how miraculous it is. How miraculous it is. I took his telephone number and I actually called him. I had seen him around, but I didn't know him. And I didn't know what would happen if I called him and he picked up the phone on the other end of the line. I called him and he answered the phone and he talked to me. And the miraculous thing is really that I called him back a second time. Because the first time, completely unsolicited by me, he started telling me what to do. Now, I don't like people to tell me what to do. I don't like that. You tell me to do something, I want to do the opposite. You know, those little skateboarder sneakers I have, they're called Rebels. I love that. You know, I don't like people to tell me what to do. A few years ago, I went to speak at that big spring fling thing that they have in Sacramento. I'm sure some of you have been there. They have this birthday cake in the back of the hall. It's the size of a house. And it's got a sign in front of it that says something like, don't molest the cake. Something like that. This kind of a sign makes me want to fling myself on top of the cake. It's just the way I am. I'm a very contrary individual. So I don't like people telling me what to do. Now, most people who come into Alcoholics Anonymous don't like anybody telling them what to do. But I was so tired. It was like, okay, okay. Now, what he told me to do was, he told me that I had to go to 7 to 9 meetings a week. I had to sit in the front row. I had to be responsible for my chair and my ashtray. I had to thank speakers whether I thought they had anything to say or not. He told me that I was essentially useless, but I had a car and I could drive other people to meetings. As you can imagine, I was very interested in social interaction. My first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous was shaking hands at the door of a meeting that those of you from L.A. will remember. It was called Wilshire Normandy. They called it that because it was on the corner of Wilshire and Normandy. Aren't they clever? A few years ago, Serenity Sam, who some of you might know, gave me an AA directory from 1966. So I looked through to see what some of the group names were and stuff. I just wanted to sort of see what they were up to in 66. There was a group out in Pomona, California called the No Donut Group. And I thought, man, what a bunch of serious fools, you know. They don't want their meeting adulterated by pastry, you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, they probably didn't even have any coffee, you know, nothing to detract from the message. Anyway, these are the kinds of things that I do to amuse myself. And I do amuse myself, by the way. Anyway. So my job, which was given to me by an old queen named Wendell J., was to shake hands at the door of Wilshire Normandy. I was a hostile greeter. You got greeted whether you wanted to be or not. They had another entrance, but we always made sure to run around and catch them if they tried to sneak in. Now, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with no life, which is a really good way to come here because I had nothing better to do than go to meetings and get there early. In fact, I would get to Wilshire an hour and a half early, and I had a place, particular place where I liked to stand by the door. And I would put my keys down on the floor. And God help you if you stood in my spot, because it was my spot. And I had sort of made a place here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bob became my sponsor. I called him up one day and I said, are you my sponsor or what? And he said to me, I guess I am. And then he spent the next 5 years trying to get rid of me. He never wanted to sponsor me. To my knowledge, the only women he ever sponsored were me and June G., Sherry's sponsor. And she probably, well, I don't know. Anyway, he just didn't want to sponsor women. And I understand that. I don't sponsor men, because I think we're here to share our experience, strength, and hope. And to my knowledge, I've never been a man. And it's like one of those female comedians. I think it's Elaine Boozler. I love her. She says, I don't have any children that I know of. Anyway, he became my sponsor. And the truth of the matter is that he was really sort of my sponsor emeritus from the beginning. I mean, I had a succession of women sponsors until I got the one that I have today. My sponsor has been in my life for 14 and a half years. Her name is Julie C. I call her the Great White Goddess, because she is just about the whitest woman in the world. I mean, she is no ordinary white woman, let me tell you. And she sort of glows in the dark. But she's sober 35 years. She's still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. She still picks up chairs and, you know, she just moved to a little town up above Fraser Park, up in one of those forests. We have it there, I think, the Los Padres. And, you know, and the town is really tiny. I mean, they have a, she said when she first moved there, they have a women's stag on Tuesday night. It's an hour and a half long. There were four women. They went over. And Saturday night meeting in Pine Mountain is huge. The last time I was there, there were nine of us. Three of us were from out of town. She's integrated herself into that little community up there and sponsors a couple of the women and is the treasurer of the group. And, you know, I mean, she's just a real AA person, you know, still an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous all these years later. And, you know, she's in my corner, and when I call her and I ask her what to do, and she tells me, I just do it, you know. And I like knowing that she's, you know, on my side, and she loves me, you know. And that's how I feel about the people I sponsor. But anyway, I was thinking on my 20th birthday, you know, I woke up in the morning, I realized I was 20, which was unbelievable. And then I started thinking about what a miracle it was that all those years before that I had taken Bobby's number and that I had actually called him. And that, you know, that I wanted. So I called him. He was living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I left him a message, and I was crying, and I said, you know, I just want to thank you for taking an interest in my case 20 years ago, because if you hadn't, I don't know where I would be today. And I just wanted to thank you. And then I hung up the phone, and then my friend Kay, who was supposed to speak here today, who couldn't be here, called me from Minneapolis to wish me a happy birthday, and I hung up the phone, and my sponsee, Cher, called me, and She said to me, she said, I want to thank you, and I want to wish you a happy birthday, and I want to thank you for taking an interest in my case 12 years ago, because if you hadn't, I don't know where I'd be today. And then I hung up the phone, and it rang again. It was Bobby from Santa Fe, and he was crying, and he said to me that I was one of the best bank shots he had ever taken. And that a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous were happy that I was still sober, and I said, no one is happier than I. But what a miracle it is. I mean, Kay talks about, my friend Kay tells a story about, actually, about June, who is no longer her sponsor but was at the beginning, and how she arrived at junior college to take a class, you know, one more time, and she got out of her car, and this little 16-year-old redheaded wild kid got out of a van, and Kay was sort of looking, and June said, where are you going? And Kay said, well, I don't know where my class is. And she said, what class are you taking? And Kay said, oh, business or whatever it was. And she said to June, what class are you taking? June said, I'm not here to take a class. I'm here to talk about alcohol and drugs. And Kay said, for or against? And and they started to talk, and June invited her to some hotel bar the next day, I think, and Kay went over there and they talked for 8 hours, and Kay talked about the miracle of telling this scrawny little 16-year-old who had 3 years of sobriety at that time stuff about herself that she had never told anybody in her whole entire life. And that's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, the magic of one drunk talking to another. You know, I was in shitloads of therapy before I came to AA, and I am not here to put down therapy. I've benefited greatly from it since I've been sober. I've had some problems that I've had to deal with in therapy, but the one thing that I do understand about therapy, and let me make a clarification, is that therapy is not and has never been my program. The only treatment that I have ever employed for my alcoholism is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I have needed some outside help. I was in tons of therapy before I came to AA, and there were four basic fundamental reasons why therapy didn't work. Number one, I didn't trust the therapist, so I always lied to them. And it's very hard to get help if you're lying. Number two, I always had the feeling that the therapist didn't understand what I was talking about, which may or may not have been true. Number three, I always felt it was my obligation to entertain them, even though I was paying them. I'm very good at that, by the way. And number four, I felt that, looking back in retrospect, I felt what they were trying to do in therapy was to get me happy enough to stop killing myself. The only problem is with chronic depressives and malcontents like me, the patient often dies before they ever get happy enough. In Alcoholics Anonymous, they take the exact opposite approach. They say, stop killing yourself first. We'll worry about the reasons later. The incredible thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that you don't have to know anything about why you drank in order to stay sober. The way you stop drinking is you stop drinking. But Alcoholics Anonymous is an amazing, amazing program. And anyway, I started getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have never stopped. The women in AA taught me how to work the steps. I had one sponsor when I was writing my inventory. By the time I was done, I was no longer talking to her. So I got another sponsor to whom I read it. And I remember reading my inventory. I remember writing my inventory and thinking, oh, you know, I've heard in the rooms that, you know, everybody experiences these vast waves of relief and they feel a part of the human race. And I didn't feel anything. There was a line in my inventory that said, please, God, let me feel something just so I know I'm alive. And, you know, what happened to me, I believe, is that, you know, there were facts and there were things down on paper, but I was not ready for the emotional impact of my own drinking at the time that I read my fifth step to my sponsor. About 2 years later, somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous did something that offended me in a sexual way, and it was very innocuous, very innocuous. But I remember I burst into tears and I said, please don't do that. Now, people had done literally thousands of things to me that should have offended me and didn't. But this one time, this sort of innocuous thing, and it burst open this whole dam. And I started, you know, really having to take a look at, you know, what had happened to me when I was drinking and the damage that had been done. And that was when I started to heal. It was very important for me to fall apart. You know, my particular disease has always manifested itself in sort of looking well. You know, I have one of those social worker personalities. You know, and if you can help other people all the time, you can take the heat off yourself and you never have to tell them anything about yourself or anything. Well, when this happened, I was like falling apart in meetings. I mean, I was crying and hyperventilating and running out of rooms and, you know, it wasn't like I could hold it together at all. And the people in Alcoholics Anonymous just let me do it. And I finally realized something so important, which is if you're worried about having an image in AA, as my first sponsor used to say, look around the room and see exactly who it is that you're trying to impress. There's no point in trying to have an image in AA. We're here to tell the truth about ourselves so that others can identify with us. There was an old guy down in LA, his name was Richard, he was a poet, he was a very sick man, and but he said some really good stuff. And one day he was in this meeting, this discussion meeting during the day, and he said, not only do we tell the truth about who we are so that we can stay here, but we tell the truth about who we are so that others can identify and be able to stay here. Because it's not only important for me to identify with who you were when you were drinking, it is vitally important for me to be able to identify with who you are clean and sober, so that I know that I am not the only one who's going through a particular experience. You know, I mean, my sobriety has been a lot about living real life and growing up. I got here when I was 24 years old. I had the maturity of a 12-year-old. And I learned how to grow up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned how to work. I learned how to be responsible. I mean, I remember when I was new, the words that I thought were dirty were not like swear words or anything. The words that I thought were dirty were words like job, you know, and responsibility and commitment. You know, those were the words that I thought were dirty. You know, because I had never been able to hold on to a job, fulfill a commitment. I lived a very marginal existence out there. You know, there's basically two kinds of people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They're the ones whose lives are fairly well together, and as a result of alcohol and or drugs, they begin to disintegrate. And then there's a group who can never get it together in the first place. I'm one of those. You know, so there's some of you in this room, I'm certain of this, who managed in their lives to, you know, collect the trappings of normal lives, you know, like lovers and, you know, cars and boats and ducks and college degrees and careers and all of that stuff while drinking, which is amazing to me. I mean, I really believe you're alcoholic. I just don't know how you did it, because I either drink or have a life. I don't do both. I don't do both because I don't function when I'm drinking. I mean, I may have a marginal job. I may check into college every once in a while just to see what's happening. But, you know, but when I go to college, I don't go to class. I major in getting loaded, rioting, and hanging out. You know, I mean, I was in college during the Vietnam War, and that's what you did. You got loaded, you rioted, you hung out. You know, every once in a while I would like, you know, I would like register for a class, but, you know, a freaky Dave and his briefcase full of drugs happened to intercept me on the way to class, you know where I was. And by 11 I was in the Howard Johnson's on Reseda Boulevard having a few cocktails and then ride my bicycle drunk through campus. You know, there she goes again. And anyway, excuse me. So I had to learn how to live life here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's been an interesting ride. It's been an interesting ride. You know, I honestly think that if you're really, you know, sometimes there's some people, I mean, everybody's entitled to their own belief, and obviously anything I say up here is my own opinion. But there are people who seem to think that if you work the steps properly, you'll never feel another moment's pain. I don't know where they get that idea, since they have little things along the way like pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth. You know, there's all these things in our literature that tell us we're not going to be perfect. Like, my personal favorite thing is right after they read the steps in Chapter 5, they read, many of us exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. And then my favorite part, no one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. You know what that means? That means that nobody has even come close. So, the point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. I am willing to grow along spiritual lines. You know, I think to myself sometimes now, you know, where would I be without the higher power? Where would I be without my higher power? You know, but this is my higher power that I found in God. I was never interested in spiritual things before I got sober. And it's only been through attrition that I've become interested in them in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to get a concept of loving God. And I got it through a lot of trial and tribulation. You know, I got to it through a seemingly bad experience. And once I got to the place where I understood that there was a loving God and that experience was just experience, I developed sort of a philosophy for my life, which I really do believe in, which is that I try to not to judge the events of my life as being good or bad or positive or negative or black or white. They're just experience. And what that means is, what I know about God, here's what I know about God. I know that God has a huge, infinite mind. What I know about me is that I have a puny, finite mind. That's what I know. Because when I'm in the middle of an experience, I can't see what's going to happen next. I don't know what's going to be moved into my life. I mean, one of the advantages of long-term sobriety, besides the fact of physical sobriety and good health for all of these years, is that I have 22 years that I can look back over where I've been awake. Important. Where I can see that every time I've needed a change in my life, God has moved a person or a situation in to act as a catalyst so that I will have a change. And not only that, but I've had that kind of spiritual awakening like they have in the back of the book. I've had a change of attitude. I really have had a change of attitude. You know, 97% of the time, I am able to view the glass as half full instead of half empty. I mean, I remember just recently I went to Italy. One of the greatest things in my life is that I've begun to travel. I think the only reason on earth to have money is to travel and to get a lot of massages. Preferably for someone to lay their hands on you in a foreign country. Anyway, and in May, my friend Gail and I went to Italy. Now, I had a cold, little, you know, thing like this, and, you know, by the time we got to Rome, I was a little cranky. I mean, there's nothing like being locked in a metal tube for 14 hours with a cold. And we arrived in Italy, and my suitcase wasn't there. Gail's was. Mine was not. I knew God liked Gail better than he liked me. I knew this. By the time we're standing in line at the Lost and Found, I am weeping. But all of a sudden, because my mind is open to other influences, this thought popped into my mind, and I thought about my friend Mary Prang, who was lying in a hospital bed in intensive care in Los Angeles because she'd had a liver transplant because hepatitis C had destroyed her liver 22 years after she got sober. And all of a sudden I thought to myself, Eileen, it's just a suitcase. It'll be here. Some guy in London went off for a cup of tea and forgot to put it on the cart. It's going to be there, you know? And we went to stay at my friend Peter's penthouse apartment two blocks from the Spanish Steps. Not bad. Met Peter in Alcoholics Anonymous. Got to have friends like that. Anyway, you know, and Peter called him up, and because he's Italian, he speaks Italian. It's so great. Do you know that in Italy, even the children and the dogs speak Italian? They are so gifted, I'm telling you. And in Paris, the children and the dogs speak French. It's incredible. Anyway, people even walked up to me in the street in Italy and thought I spoke Italian. They were wrong. Anyhow, he called them, and he got it all straightened out in Italian, and, you know, and he stayed up till midnight till they delivered my suitcase, and it was in front of my door in the morning. It was fine, you know. But it's like you get a different way of looking at life here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The traveling has been great. You know, I really thought that, you know, when I was new, that I wouldn't have any freedom anymore. Well, how much freedom do you have when you can't get 2 feet from the liquor store or the connection? I mean, you know, that's not freedom. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I've had the freedom to go anywhere and do anything. You know, years ago I read an article in a magazine called Unity, put out by the Unity Church, and they, again, I'm using all these dog metaphors, but they compared the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous to a beloved pet dog. And what they said in this article was that as long as the dog stays in its yard, it's safe, and it doesn't get run over by a car or carried off by somebody or given poison meat. But if it should get out of the yard, you know, some terrible fate could befall it. And they talked about Alcoholics Anonymous and the men and women here and how our yard is our primary purpose, essentially, that we stay sober and carry the message. And as long as we remember we can't drink, we can really go anywhere or do anything. And that's been my experience. I mean, I've been to Italy. I love reggae music. I went to Jamaica. People said to me, how can you go to Jamaica and not smoke dope? I said, how can I live in Los Angeles and not smoke dope? I mean, I was relaxed in Jamaica. I have the pictures to prove it, you know. And I mean, you know, I've been to Paris, and you know, and I've been to Mexico, but by far my most interesting trip was to Israel, because I went there for 6 weeks to work in 1987, and, you know, I don't know how it is up around here. I'm sure that you don't have as many meetings, obviously, as we have in L.A. We have like 2,400 meetings a week in the greater Los Angeles area. But in Israel, you take what you can get, which means that I went to a women's stag on Wednesday. We had four people. I went out to visit some very bizarre loners on the West Bank. And then I went to NA meetings in a bomb shelter in Tel Aviv. One night I gave a talk. It was translated from English into Hebrew by a native German-speaking woman. I don't know what they heard, but anyway. Several years later, I got a call at 6 o'clock on Sunday morning, a time that I always want to get a call. And it's this guy, and he says, "My name is Osmail. I met you in Israel. I'm in Spring Valley, New York. Do you know where there's an NA meeting?" I think, I don't even know where Spring Valley, New York. But I said, "I'll try and help you." And he spoke very little English. So I called Central Office of Narcotics Anonymous in New York City. I hope someday all of you have this. Guy answers the phone. He goes, "Hi, I'm Joey. I'm an addict." And I think, "Ah, who is it? Shut up, you know." And anyway, I told him the story. And whatever. Before I went to Israel, I had a crisis whose name I can't currently remember. So if you're having one of those, it'll pass. My sponsor had abandoned me and gone to Arizona to do a play or something. So I called my first sponsor. I hadn't talked to him in many years. And he laughed. He said, "Of course you call me. I have to give you Nancy and Bob Wilson's phone number in Tel Aviv." I said, "Who are they?" He said, "There's some people I met in Hawaii, but they've moved to Israel. They're in the program." So I called Nancy, and I told her my name, and she said, "Oh, I know who you are." And I said, "How do you know who I am?" And she said, "Well, about a month ago, somebody from AA in the States that I didn't know sent me a bunch of AA tapes, and one of them was yours." Anyway, while I was there, she saved my butt. I was not getting along with my employer. I was, you know, tough. Anyhow, when I came back to Los Angeles, Nancy and her husband split up, and she moved to Santa Monica, which is essentially Los Angeles, and I was able to reciprocate. And then she remarried, and she and her new husband went back to Israel, and she went to the NA meeting in the bomb shelter, and there was Avnev, the telephone call, and he was clean, so maybe I helped him. Anyhow, while I was there, I went to Egypt. Why? Because you can. And I love this. You know, I'm somebody who couldn't get up off the floor, but now I'm riding a camel and touching the Sphinx. I'm going in the pyramids. I take a 2-day whirlwind tour of Egypt, which is a country where you feel loaded even when you're not, because it's very exotic and really hot, like 190 degrees. And we were driving around in this un-air-conditioned Fiat. And by the end of the day, the second day, I'm reclining in the Perfume Palace in Giza, which is where the Sphinx and the big pyramids are and stuff, and I'm half dead from this excursion. And I'm 12 and a half years sober, and I don't know what it is about me, but some guy I've never seen before in my life walks up to me and he says, "I can get you some hashish." My immediate thought is, I'm in Egypt. Who would know? And I thought to myself, you'd better get your ass back to that bomb shelter, even if you don't understand anything they're saying, because the disease never sleeps. Which is why I still go to meetings. I go to meetings because I need them. I go to meetings because I like them. I go to meetings because, as my sponsor Julie C., the great white goddess, says, that's where they keep the newcomers. And the fourth and most compelling reason why I go to meetings is because most of the time I look and act less like an alcoholic than I ever have in my whole entire life. And the reason why I go to meetings is because I need to remind myself that the only thing that stands between the woman you see today and the one who walked into Alcoholics Anonymous was a drink. Now, I have one other thing I want to talk about. I'm going to talk about it in about 2 minutes because it's important. Have I used up all my tape?
No.
Good. Because this is important. Part of the wreckage of my past is that when I was 18 years old, I had a son that I gave up for adoption. Signed the papers 3 days later. Never thought about it again too much. Except on his birthday, and when I was about 30 and 6 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had sufficiently thawed out from being so cool that I was frozen that I went and made inquiry about it for the one and only time. I made a decision based on conversations that I had had with people on all sides of what they call the adoption triangle, people who had given up kids, people who had adopted kids, kids who were adopted. I made a decision that I was not going to search for him, that it would be an invasion of his privacy and that of the people who adopted him. And I have to be honest with you, I don't have huge, strong maternal instincts, although little Nathan could come live at my house whenever he wants. You know, I didn't have this huge need to know where he was or any of that stuff. I just sort of felt that it was in God's hands. And I honestly thought that I'd never meet him. So a year ago on July 4th, I was sitting on my couch drinking a cup of coffee, happy to be off for 4 days, thinking eventually I'd get off my ass, go to the store, buy some stuff for the salad I had promised to take to the party later. Very relaxed, very calm, phone rings. It's a woman. She says, "My name is Julie Jones. I'm a private search investigator from Seattle, Washington. I've been asked to locate you." So I wonder which one of my friends in Washington has gotten themselves into trouble. I thought, I wonder what Christine has done now. She said to me, "Is your name Eileen Waterstone?" And I said, "Yes." And she says, "Does the date March 28th, 1969 mean anything to you?" And then I knew, and I burst into tears. I said, "Is he in Seattle?" She said, "Oh, no, he's in your area code." They do it all by computer. She gave me the phone number. I recognized it as being a phone number from West Hollywood, so my first thought was, I wonder if he's gay. My second thought was, I wonder if he's an Orthodox Jew, which is your other demographic in West Hollywood. And my third thought was, I wonder if I'm a grandmother. He's none of the above. He's a huge 6'3", strapping, gorgeous, heterosexual alcoholic. He's now 28 years old. He currently has about 80 days of sobriety. Our first conversation, he told me he's been in a drug rehab. I told him, "Great, I've got 21 years in AA." And I thought about it later, and I thought, he's probably sitting on the other end of the line going, "Oh, shit, she's on to me." She knows, you know. And he wasn't sober most of the time I knew him. He made a sort of a start earlier this year, and then he got mad at some people, so then he was drinking beer and going to one meeting a week, which works beautifully. But I never did anything. I mean, I seem to have some sort of ingrained Al-Anon thing. I mean, I really understand that it's none of my business, and it's not my job to help him. But he came to a meeting where I talked about 2.5 months ago, and he heard me talk. I took him out to dinner. He was going on and on about this and that, and finally he said, I said, "Aaron, if you give me your permission, I'll tell you what I think." So I told him what I thought, but more importantly, that night at the meeting, he got the number of a very cute blonde who's serious about sobriety. And she directed him to go to meetings that I would have chosen for him and introduced him to a guy that I really like who became his sponsor, and now he's sober. And, I've met his parents. What a trip. They're his parents, I'm his mother. They're nice Jewish people. They're the kind of people I've known my whole entire life. I am sure they are baffled by this huge alcoholic in their midst. And you know what? I had never any doubt that they would like me. I never had any doubt that he would like me. And, you know, the great miracle in this whole story is, it's great that, he came into my life at a time when he needed to get sober and I was here to be his ally. But here's the great miracle of the story. Can you imagine what would have been on the other end of that line if I wasn't an Alcoholics Anonymous? Can you imagine what he would or wouldn't have found on the other end of the line if I wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? My life in Alcoholics Anonymous is so wonderful. It says in our book that when all else fails, help another alcoholic. I hope I've done that this morning. Thank you very much. Yeah.